following program is paid for by Little John Financial Services. The opinions and views expressed may not reflect those of Brook Communications, its affiliates, or its employees.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4. Every weekday, News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN brings you local information at 4 o'clock. Now presented by Little John Financial Services. It's David Little John with True Wealth on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
All right, gang, you know what time it is. It is time for the True Wealth Radio Show on this, the greatest Tuesday we've had all week. I'm your host, Dave Littlejohn, and in studio with me today,
Matt Dixon, as usual.
Yep, and Emma's not on the mic today. She is here, so feel free to taunt her. We certainly will. Okay, today I have a show that we probably should have done a long time ago. It's one that is probably going to be pretty evergreen, meaning you can grab this podcast, and if you're listening to this and it's a year from now, it's probably still relevant, although the numbers will have sort of shifted around, and I'll be curious if my theory has played out, right? Mm. So if you're listening to this and it's future you, then this will be fun.
Do you ever go back and actually listen to yourself just to be like, haha, I was right?
So I don't do it for that reason. I've gone back and listened a little bit. What I've done is I've put a bunch of things into AI systems and gone back so I can see what topics have been covered before.
Please ask AI, like, what percentage of the time was I accurate? Because if it's more than 50%, you're basically a genius, right? As far as stocks go?
Yeah, except for the part where I probably didn't make those kinds of predictions. So it's things like, I predict the sun's going to rise tomorrow. And it's like, he's a genius. Oh.
So it'd actually be really funny to make a series of videos where you make tons of predictions that are so.
What you do is you make a video of both predictions, right? Put them online, and then you go back and only fish out the ones that were right.
There you go.
That's pretty much how just the cheaters do it, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, because nobody ever cherry picks data, right? Except for all of them. Oh, man, I love hyperbole. Now, let's talk about this. This one, Matt, it's really bugging me.
Okay.
It's bugged me for a long time. But in this scenario, it's just time that we have a discussion about it. And the question is, what is what's the problem with bonds? We shouldn't start with that. It should be, what about bonds
is the problem?
I've already sort of given this idea that I have a bit of a distaste for the asset class. That does not mean that I don't own them. They do serve a purpose. But my sense is that we have a lot of thinking around bonds that people don't even know where it comes from. They just know, well, you're supposed to own them because we've been told this so long that it's just become dogma. It's a little bit like my generation, the food pyramid had a whole lot more carbs and dairy in it. And then today, the food pyramid looks very different. But if you talk about it like, well, when I was a child, this is what they told me, so I need to go eat some more carbs. You're like, yeah, that had nothing to do with what was healthy. It had everything to do with what was influencing the food pyramid at the time of its creation.
Yeah.
You know, and throughout our lifetime, I think eggs have been bad, then good, then bad, then good. Then it was only the egg whites, and then only the egg yolks, and then it was cholesterol, then it wasn't cholesterol. By the time you listen to this, eggs may cause cancer, they may cure it. I don't even know.
How many eggs do you think you eat on average a day?
A day?
Yeah. Do you eat eggs every morning?
No, not
for
every day, but they're pretty common in my diet.
Oh, okay.
Because they're just a really clean source of protein.
It's true.
You know, it's a very easy source of protein.
Scrambled eggs or an omelet?
Yes.
Over hard or over easy?
All right. So now you're really getting personal here.
I'm
actually, like, my favorite way to have eggs is over easy on top of hash browns.
Oh, you like it all runny?
Not super runny, but yes, I will still have the eggs because it's more like a sauce to me.
Mm.
And then I add some hot sauce to it and it's good to go.
It grosses my wife out, but like when I do my eggs, I do it over hard and I add a little bit of water to the pan with a lid over it so it kind of steams them.
It's blanching.
Yeah.
It's a thing.
I like it, but the smell I think is offensive. So
you don't flip the egg. What you do is you start frying it like sort of sunny side up,
yep.
Add some water and then throw a lid over it and then it steams it. Sealed.
Yeah, but I like it. I don't like it runny. Something about that just. Ugh.
All right. Well, I mean, to each their own.
Yeah.
If I'm going to eat it that way, I prefer to scramble an egg because I kind of like the flavor all mixed together.
What about a good omelet? You like a good omelet?
Yeah. It depends on kind of what's in it, but yeah, I can go with a good omelet.
Okay. How do we wrap omelets into the Bond?
Yeah, I really don't know. Other than, let's use this right here. All right, here's a stretch. The omelet, the issue is it's sometimes the sum of the parts does not equal the whole. In an omelet, everything comes together and it's great.
Yep.
In an investment portfolio, everything comes together and it's great. But the individual pieces aren't necessarily the magic, right? Mm-hmm. It's not the individual ingredients that make the omelet.
So it's not the Bond necessarily that's making the magic in a portfolio.
Right. The Bond has a role, but I think what's happened is we have skipped over educating people on why we care about bonds in the first place, what that role is, and as a result, people conflate bonds to mean something that they don't necessarily mean.
Well, and not all bonds are the same, like a short-term bond versus a long-term bond, right? Like if you're loaning your money out over a short period of time where the bond is due in just a couple years, that can be a very different situation versus something like over 20 years.
Well, yes. I mean, let's clarify for our listeners, because I think what you're really hinting at is that the purpose is not always the same for each bond.
Right.
I mean, because a bond is a bond in that it's a loan instrument.
So for me, like, I look at a bond as an instrument where I'm going to need the money, or I presume I might need the money within a very short period of time, right? Like within a year or two. And it's like, well, or less. Sometimes it's like 3 to 6 months. Maybe I would put my money in a bond because, okay, I'm going to go collect 4% interest over the next 12 months, but I might need it early and I might need to sell it.
See, here, I actually think you're illustrating something perfect right now. I'm going to challenge you on air. Now, just so you know,
go for it.
Matt is, it's not fair when we don't prep for something like this, but because I'm not trying to pick on Matt when I do this. I want to understand you just described a type of asset.
Mm-hmm.
You said, oh, I want an asset scenario here. What I'm going to suggest is what you're actually looking for is a risk management scenario, and the bond happened to be suitable.
Correct. Yeah.
Okay. This is really important for folks to understand, because I think risk is generally misunderstood as investors. There's the way that air quotes smart money, which is usually, you know, institutional or in particular institutional bond investors are historically known as the smart money. Okay. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that's very fair. Right. This idea like, oh, well, that's smart money. Everybody else is dumb. That's really pretty irritating to hear to me. Instead, let's think about this as money has different roles and different needs to secure as collateral and cash flow. Let's think about this for a second. Let's suppose that you're a mortgage company and you need to have enough money to secure, or pensions even better. Pensions are a really good one. Pensions have a certain amount of payout requirement.
Mm-hmm.
So what are you going to do if you have to pay out a certain ratio of your money all the time? You're going to find instruments that create predictable cash flow for you in order to meet those obligations.
Right.
And then you're going to structure that. And in order to produce the hedge against long-term inflation, you're going to have to add other assets to it. So if we think as investors, then this is usually why this works out. When somebody's very young and they have a long time horizon and they don't have a current income need, they can buy us away from fixed income instruments because they don't need current cash flow. What they really need is a hedge against inflation and they want to grow the assets.
Yeah.
So we look at this and say, oh, okay, well, then we don't need to have that many bonds for a young person. But then somehow we got it in our minds that, well, when you get older, you have to start owning bonds.
That's because always been you need a wild to, one to me. Yeah.
What's that?
That's always been a wild theory to me, and I've heard it so many times from people that just come in and they're like, oh, yeah, you know, I guess I'm supposed to own it because I'm old. And I'm like, well, wait a minute. Do you? Because, like, what if your financial situation is such where, like, you don't really need the money in this portfolio? And it's like, well, maybe you can afford to take more risk. You don't have to be obligated to a bond strictly because of your age.
Hint, everybody listening. The phrase that was snuck in there subtly is, well, maybe you can afford to take the risk.
Mm-hmm.
See, that the afford the risk, or willing to take the risk, able to take the risk, or should you take the risk? But the key phrase in there is the risk component.
Yeah.
Somebody walks in and they've pre-programmed themselves to say, well, as I age, I'm supposed to own more bonds because that's safer.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm here to tell you is That is not intrinsically true. Bonds do not intrinsically imply safety. And it's a misnomer. It's like people just don't get it. But we've been sort of conditioned to believe these things because we hear it again and again and again. It's sort of like the S&P 500 is diversified. I go, okay, there's 500 positions, but a third of them are in about a dozen stocks.
You make a valid point, because if you look at what's been going on with like the 30-year lately, if you had had a ton of money in that alone, you would maybe be hurting a little bit right now.
This, incidentally, is one of the few things that's going to date this show. It doesn't mean we're going to change the – because if you go back and listen to when we did this, you're going to say, oh, well, what was going on with the 30-year? Mm-hmm. And the 30-year bond has – you've seen the price has fallen.
Yeah, a lot.
The price has fallen a lot. The price of the bond. But what has gone up, Matt?
The yield's gone up.
The yield has gone up, and the yield's pretty significant. It's the highest it's been
in over 20 years.
Yes, it's like since 2006 or something, seven?
Yeah.
Basically pre-real estate crisis.
Yeah.
It's the highest that we've seen the yield on. What does that imply?
That implies that in
Hold on.
Pause. Let them think. Let them think.
What do you, because I want everybody to think about, say, I'm going to do this. We're going to take a break. I want everybody to wonder, like, great, we've got rates higher. What does this imply? When we come back, I'm going to explain it. So stick around. Until then, yeah, you don't want to turn the dial, because I'll tell you what, it's going to matter to you. I'm Dave Littlejohn.
And Matt Dixon.
And you got True Wealth on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
Yeah, I mean, it's not semantic, though. It sounds like... All right, welcome back to the True Wealth Show. Dave Littlejohn in studio with
Matt Dixon.
Okay, and if you're just joining us, you're going to want to grab the podcast and get caught up. Matt, when we went to break, okay, we were talking about this idea that 30-year government bonds yield is as high as it's been since like 2007.
Yeah, I think it closed at like, what, 5.1 something? Yeah.
It's higher than we've seen in a long time. We've seen higher mortgage rates. We're seeing higher interest rates. We're even seeing higher, not a lot higher CD rates yet.
No, not yet. That's the interesting one. A lot of the short-term stuff is still,
It is, but it isn't. And I'll explain why. We're going to break this apart now.
Okay.
So the question that I wanted to ask for our listeners is, what does it mean when the yield has gone up in these 30-year positions? What is it telling us?
A lot of people just weren't lining up to buy the stuff where the yield was, you know, at 3. And so then the, you know, everything changes and now it's at 4. And oh, there's still no buyers. So now the yield trickles higher, and eventually here we are in the 5s.
Yeah, and I'm going to tell you something kind of wild, and I want our listeners to hear this too, because it's just confusing. What everybody thinks is, oh, well, the yield has to go up until people buy it. And what I'm going to tell you is, it's while that is true, sort of, it's not the yield that's actually changing. So the yield is set by demand.
Right.
Yield is, it's not like, well, in order to have 6% yields, this is how much everything costs. It is because people will only pay this much for it, this is the equivalent yield.
Yeah, so you get into the area of the market where you're talking about a bond either trading at a premium or a discount to its par value.
Correct. But here's why it matters. We have this tendency to sort of conflate the yield with mortgages. Right. And if you think about it that way, you'd say, oh, well, if rates are really high, then nobody goes out and gets mortgages. So there's fewer people buying houses.
Yeah.
But if rates get really low, then there's more people buying mortgages. And we think, well, the rate is what's causing it. Well, that's true for mortgages. But in the bond marketplace, remember, the bond already exists most of the time. And this is people trading existing bonds.
Mm-hmm.
If you had to decide whether or not you could sell your mortgage to somebody else, which... By the way, behind the scenes, that's exactly what financial institutions do.
Right.
If you've ever had a mortgage where you're discovering, oh, well, now it's being serviced by somebody else. It used to be brand X and now it's brand Y. they're selling the mortgage obligation to somebody else, either the servicing or sometimes they're actually selling the instrument itself.
Mm-hmm.
Because you've created a debt instrument, right? There's a house as collateral, you're paying interest. So somebody is going to buy this stream of income, which is you paying your mortgage.
Yeah.
If we think about this example that I'm sharing with you, if nobody's willing to take out a mortgage, then what does a bank have to do?
They have to lower the rate until someone shows
right.
up.
Right. They have to make it low enough to attract people to borrow.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the problem that they run into is, what is their intrinsic cost of having the money in the first place to loan?
Right. It has to make sense to them.
Yeah. Maybe it costs them 4% to have that money between their operating costs.
Right. And then they charge you 5% and they
make charge 5% and they make the spread. Right. That's their
bonds
profit.
Bonds are a little different because people own the bonds and they're trying to buy and sell them.
Well, let's look at it this way, Matt. If I offered you two different loan deals,
mm-hmm.
one of them is, hey, can I borrow $1,000 from you and I'll pay you 10% interest on it for the next 2 years?
Deal.
Okay. I say, well, how about can I borrow $1,000 from you and I'll pay you 9% for the next 2 years?
Deal.
Oh, we're still good. Yeah. How about, can I pay you 8% for the next 2 years?
Now it's starting to get a little more questionable because it's like, well, can I get more than that in the market?
Yeah. And so, yeah. And what are you really saying to me?
I'm trying to determine whether or not I can put my money somewhere else and get a better deal.
Well, and the better deal is, can I make
more.
As much or more money somewhere else with the same or more attractive risk
right.
profiles?
If you offered me 2%, yeah. I'd be like, kick rocks.
Right, because yeah. I can put it just about anywhere and get paid more than that.
Right.
What we're really reflecting is the cost of capital and the cost of the risk.
Exactly.
And that's, I think it's really important. Listen to that phrase again. It's the cost of capital, which is how much does it cost somebody to borrow money compared to the risk associated, which is who's lending it.
Mm-hmm.
That's really the pricing things that we have to consider, right? The pricing elements are, you looked at this and said, I'm going to loan money to you. How yeah. likely am I going to get paid back? What else could I do instead? And might that be more attractive? I had to look at this and say, can I afford to pay you what you need?
Mm-hmm.
It took both.
It did.
This is risk pricing.
And you see it in the bond market.
Yeah. And that's really what's going on in the fixed income marketplace. Now, let's talk about portfolio theory and what's supposed to happen here. If I have a stock and it goes up and down in value,
mm-hmm.
okay, and I want to reduce the amount of risk. So up and down is that's volatility, and we call that risk in the market, the big swings up and down.
Yep.
And I don't want to experience big swings as an investor. Then what do I need to do?
You need to diversify your holdings into something that might not swing as much.
Okay, that's one thing I can do.
Yeah.
Right? So I need to don't just own the one thing. What if I diversify my holdings and they all go up and down at the same time?
Well, you're not very diversified then, I guess.
Well, it's interesting because you may be very diversified, but what you still are
is just a lot of correlation, I guess.
So yeah, this is the problem is everything is going up and down with the tide at the same time.
Yeah.
And so that high degree of correlation means as an investor, I'm not benefiting from having different behaviors in all of my investments. I may still be safer. Right, I'm diversified, yeah. So if one of them goes out of business, I still own the others.
Stocks and bonds used to be, you know, walking really separately of each other. Like one would go up, one would kind of go down. But would you say that things have kind of shifted a little bit more to where now the correlation aspect is higher than it
yeah.
used to be?
Yeah, and that's the phrase that we're looking for, is the reason that bonds existed is because they've historically had lower volatility at different times than stocks.
Yeah.
It's not that they have lower volatility, period. Bonds actually have pretty good volatility in the marketplace.
Mm-hmm.
But they historically have had a little bit less than bonds, than stocks. So you would say, well, then they should be mathematically lower risk because there's lower volatility. But it's the fact that they've historically behaved at different points in time. So they weren't affected by the tide at the same time.
Yeah.
Right? You got to think about if stocks were boats floating on the top of the ocean, then bonds were like submarines. They would go up and down under the ocean, but the tide isn't what moved them very much. They moved independently of the tide. And so it made for nice complements because there was less probability that they would both decline at the same time. That was the benefit.
Right.
Low correlation meant lower risk that everything fell simultaneously. Well, what we've seen over the last, especially over the last 10 years or so, is we've seen an increase in correlation in stocks and bonds.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, so what does that mean, Matt?
Sorry, I was pulling up a stat. I wanted to pull up a real
stat. Which is great, but I mean, like let's intuitively.
Say, ask it again. I'm paying attention.
What does it mean that stocks and bonds over the last 10 years have behaved with higher correlation?
It just means like if bonds are going down, stocks are probably going down more often than not, right where they used to go separate of each other. And I think 2022 was when we really started to see some of the correlation tighten.
A lot more correlation.
And I think a lot of it had, from everything I've read, had to do a lot with the inflationary piece driving it, right?
Oh, yeah. If my theory is, if you can go back to really when we had the European currency crises, and it kind of started with, we called them pigs back then, right? So it's Portugal and Ireland and Italy and Greece and Spain. And Portugal, right? Those were all these European economies that they were struggling because what you really had was Britain, France, and Germany had more economic output than these other countries. And over time, that growing disparity meant that they were all trying to sync up to the euro as their currency, but they didn't have the same productive output.
Yeah.
And so these other smaller countries, their economies couldn't keep up, and it was straining the entire European Union. And when that happened, that currency crisis rippled into the equity markets, and it affected things and affected the way risk was priced globally because people hedge currencies too. And so as the euro declined in value and it destabilized some of those those currency hedges, you started to see the Federal Reserve change policy too. And we've seen a lot more intervention from the Federal Reserve. Think back to Ben Bernanke, right? This is over 10 years ago now. But when Ben Bernanke was the Fed chair, there was a joke. He said if he had to, he would throw money from helicopters into the streets in order to print enough money to keep the asset prices stable. He had to generate inflation because we couldn't have a deflationary environment.
Yeah.
So if you look at that scenario, ever since then, the cost of capital, remember that phrase, right? I said earlier, that cost of capital was being affected by Federal Reserve policy. And so that influenced the way the market behaved. Now, it did pump up asset prices, which benefits the stock market over time, but it devalued the bonds at the same time. So now you had this change in the relationship of stocks and bonds.
Yeah.
Because you were changing the value of currency. And I think that's been going on ever since. The Federal Reserve's taken a lot more active role in the economy in the Bernanke years and forward.
It'll be interesting to see how our new Fed chair handles things because we're kind of at this pivot point where inflation is obviously pesky. And here we see, you know, bond rates doing what they're doing. And so he's going to have some interesting decisions to make.
Yeah, I think every Fed chair has an interesting balance to hold up.
This is just a really tough time, I think, for him to walk into this.
You know,
like, Powell's kind of exiting it, to me, it seems like the perfect point because, honestly, it seems like he did a pretty good job up until this point. Like, I feel like, you know how everyone talks about a soft landing versus a kind of a hard landing in this? And he's managed through, you know, the money printing phase and COVID and all this other stuff. Here we are. Things haven't looked that bad. And, market return wise and like keeping things somewhat stable. Like, I think he could have done a lot worse job.
Well, it's interesting. I think there's some subjectivity to his performance, right? And I'm actually relatively aligned with what you're saying, but at the same time, I look at this and think, well, housing has been more expensive as a percentage of the average person's income than any point in modern history.
Yep.
That we have seen minimum wage have to go up materially. You know, you're seeing Taco Bell hiring at $15 to $18 an hour.
Yep.
It used to be half of that. So we're seeing some real significant changes in the value and purchasing power of our currency. And so what people are getting paid versus what they can afford has really changed. Yeah. So there's been a lot of inflation. I mean, particularly in the housing market. I don't think fuel prices are a good shot right now. I think that, you know, we've got other geopolitical issues that are destabilizing that. But housing's a big one. And then I think energy is a really big one.
Yeah.
If we look at the cost that you pay your power bill. You're not using more kilowatt hours significantly than you were 5 years ago, but your power bill is probably double.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Well, that's inflation is what that is. And so if the Fed had a dual mandate of full employment and maintaining inflation at approximately 2%, we exceeded 2%.
Oh, big time.
Pretty significantly.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's where it's like, well, I don't know how we frame that one up. But yeah, it's also hard because everybody will say, well, we went through a pandemic. So, well, we did.
Yeah.
This is the closest to when I told you so that you get on the air, which is when they were printing money and saying, guys, inflation's coming.
Yeah, you were screaming it on air. You're like, stop.
Yeah,
this
4 years.
Gonna
it's
hurt.
We'll feel it. And it's like, we are feeling it. And
yeah,
that's when I could go back and pull them out and say,
I remember it vividly because you said it so many times. You're like,
this is not what you think. You feel like it feels good today. You're going to be mad tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, that's where we arrived at. I'm looking at the clock. I'm amazed how quickly it's going. But
when we get back from this break, I want you to talk a little bit about how, you know, historically when the yields kind of are higher, what happens with the flow of money in equities. So keep that in mind. I'm going to pry you a little bit on this one because I saw some interesting stats that you might want to hear.
All right. So we'll look into those and more. Again, the bond markets hint at behaviors, and what we're going to try to do is play detective. Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Dave Littlejohn.
And Matt Dixon.
And you got True Wealth on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
Hey, gang, welcome back to the True Wealth Show, where today we are unpacking bonds. We're trying to make sense of these, and so Matt and I are having some fun. You, I know, you want to quiz me on this. I've got plenty of opinions, but I'm really trying to make this an education show about bonds. I started out with this idea that as if I really dislike them. It's actually not the case. What I dislike about bonds
is like a reliance upon them.
A misunderstanding, right?
Okay.
It's any time that somebody sort of makes a statement that's, it'd be like if some dumb one, like the moon's made of cheese. It's like, well, there is a moon, but it's not made of cheese. Right.
How do you know? It looks like Swiss. No.
Dang it, Matt. I can't take
you
anywhere.
Been there? Have you tasted it?
I cannot take you anywhere.
No, you can't.
I know, because we laser the moon. How about that? Okay. What's your question?
I was just curious. You know, typically you hear about the bond market is doing this, that, or the other. It's because equities, there's a sell-off in equities and people are taking that money and then investing in bonds. Would you say that you think that that's really the case this time around, or do you think that we really haven't seen it that way?
Define this time around.
I mean, with the, you know, yields going higher, do you think that it's do you think that people have been selling off equities in order to go buy bonds?
That doesn't intuitively make sense to me, because with yields rising, it suggests that there's not demand in the marketplace. So absent demand, the price is falling.
Right.
So if you had people running into that environment, I would think that the prices would be going up and yields would decline because of demand. So it doesn't ring true to me that people are running there because of yield. It suggests to me that the yield is going higher because nobody is running there.
Well, at a certain point, I guess I should have said, at a certain point, people start to run there because the yields are super high, right? Like if 5 goes to 7 or to 8, or even back to like what it was in the 70s or late or early 80s when it was what, 12 or 13? I think it even got higher than that.
It did in some cases,
like,
yes.
I mean, if it jumped magically in the next couple of weeks to 13%, you'd be loading up, right, on bonds?
It there would definitely be attractive,
right,
at that point.
So,
provided that we don't have a backdrop that becomes hyperinflationary, meaning that we lose control of the currency entirely and it just becomes exotic, right? So, oh, well, rates at 13 seem great until they go to 40.
Yeah.
But at that point, I would suggest we actually have a structural collapse in our currency.
Right.
So, but if we saw 13, 14, 15% in government treasuries, without giving investment advice when I say this, if those numbers showed up, it would be tempting to go ahead and take the risk of buying them, because on a risk-reward basis, your game changes from how much am I going to get paid if it goes higher to, if it doesn't collapse, I'm going to get paid great. If it does collapse, my money was worthless anyway. So it was kind of the risk started to make sense at that level. Because you have to consider that your money becomes worthless at some point, so it doesn't matter where you put it.
Yeah.
So I think at those levels, provided that the currency ultimately was stabilized, it would work out pretty well.
And it was kind of a setup question, because I was looking at the stats, and it appears as if there isn't a huge move yet to go buy bonds at 5-something percent.
Well, sure. Let's frame it this way so our listeners can understand it. Hey, Matt, will you loan me money for the next 30 years at 5% with everything that you see going on in the world right now?
I mean, personally, no, I wouldn't.
Why not?
I mean, the market's been averaging 10 to 12%. So it's like, do I want half the return?
The answer is because if I have to wait 30 years to get paid back, I'm going to make a crap ton more money anywhere but there.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, like, I don't want to give up control of my money for 30 years for only 5%.
Yeah.
The only people that are doing that are people that are managing the yield curve because they have pensions or something where they have to have consistent payouts. But it doesn't make sense right now when you can get 7% in the high yield markets on a 2-year payback.
Yeah.
Like, well, for a little bit more risk and not significantly more default risk, why don't I just get paid without tying my money up that long?
Right.
So it looks to me like risk is mispriced in the marketplace right now.
So you look at this as kind of almost a normal move, because
if 5% maybe not normal,
still
but
doesn't seem attractive to you, most people will still look at this and be like, it's still not interested.
Yeah, it's an explainable move. Like, normal is probably the wrong terminology in my world. Okay. I wouldn't call this normal. I would simply say that it does, the data fits the behavior pattern.
Yeah.
You know, okay. I look at it and say, we have a government that is at war with itself. There are two material factions right now, and they're not partisan in the sense of like left or right, more so than global versus national. And you kind of see this play out in other ways too. And this is not the show to really debate that, but the globalist idea of let's get all of the countries sort of generally aligned and unify currency and legal systems and march down that path together versus the nationalist side, which is, nope, everybody's sovereign to do what they feel is best for their citizenry, and the duty of the country is to the immediate citizens rather than to the entire globe. Those are philosophical differences. We're not going to solve those on this show today.
But can we solve?
Well, we can just talk about the stuff. I don't know how much we could. I can tell you what we solve.
I want you to solve it right now.
Here's the solve. We get to work with people one at a time and help them navigate the gauntlet that is their financial system, improve their own decisions so that they are positioned to survive this. I'm not going to go and change the world a country at a time. We're going to change the world one investor at a time.
Okay. So what would your biggest message be to the investor that is, say, like in that phase where they're retiring or getting close to retiring and they're looking at their portfolio and they're like, man, you know, I'm 50% in bonds. Like, do you have like anything that you can even say on air to that person?
Sure, sure. What I would say is you really should examine the cash flow needs.
Like of what you need to have from your portfolio in retirement.
Yeah. Here's a better way to say, what are the withdrawal needs from that account? Because if you don't ever need to take money out of it, then it doesn't really matter, right? The risk is more about, well, what do I kind of feel like is the right thing? But if you're never planning on using, I got a pension, I'm never going to touch this money. That changes the dynamic of how you would invest, because it opens up a whole host of options. versus the person that says, this is my nest egg. It has to last me until my last breath, and I have to protect it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? You have a different need set. And so you address it that way. You address it by saying, what is your income need? And then we have to do some actuarial work that's not super fun, but it's like, how long are you going to keep breathing? Right? Because we got to do that math a little bit. And then we got to build a little cushion and to say, like, well, what if you make it longer than that?
Yeah.
What if something goes a little wrong? We need to kind of build some cushion.
It really is crazy, you know, looking at life expectancy, how much that can change a plan and the investment strategy. Like, if you're hey, I haven't been healthy in 20 years and I'm going to croak at 65 versus the person that comes in. And they're like, yeah, everyone in my family lives over 100. And it's like, wow, you know, maybe we need to.
Well, these are relevant factors.
Yeah.
And so I look at this and say, what you need to figure out is how much of a withdrawal does this portfolio need to support? And then you reverse engineer to that. And then you talk about your comfort zone with risk, meaning how much volatility can you endure without flipping out? Some mm-hmm. people can't see changes on their statement. They just, they'll panic and then they'll short circuit the decisions.
So it needs to be engineered. Did you ever think of yourself as an engineer?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I could get way too into things. Like, I have to design all the things. No, this is just personalized problem solving but the engineering units are monetary. Mm-hmm. You know, some people have to build bridges so that they don't collapse when cars drive over them.
We're building a bridge that
just
gets
or, you know,
from
building a house with trusses that don't collapse. Okay, those all matter. You don't want the second floor of your house to be in the first floor of your house. Well,
unless the first floor is a swimming pool, that could be a pretty epic collapse.
So when Matt used to work for me, I really liked him. But no. I don't even know how I come back from that. Thanks.
You're welcome.
I think that with the financial instruments, this is the bigger issue, though. When somebody is looking at saying, well, I've got 50% stocks, that may not be a problem,
mm-hmm.
but it may not be optimized given the conditions.
Yeah.
The reality is that conditions change, and what you want to do is position yourself so that you are risk appropriate for what you can tolerate and what you need. What does your plan need in order to be successful from a probability perspective, right? Because you could say, well, I'm going to go out and put everything in CDs and I'm going to earn 2% on them. I said, yeah, but you need 6% withdrawals. So you're assuring yourself that you're not going to make it. Eventually, you will run out of money. And the only way that you get out of this is to die earlier.
I hate that because some people, that's like the hill they'll die on. They're like, no, I refuse to take more risk. And you're just looking at the numbers and you're like, but you have a finite amount of money and your Social Security is blank. Those two numbers don't work well together.
Well, remember, there is an easy solution to this.
Die early?
Yeah, well, there's two easy solutions now. Die early or never stop working. Keep earning, right? So that you don't need a nest egg because you still have an income source.
Those are not the fun ones, are they?
No, they're not.
Because I'm sure you've had to tell many a people, hey, well, given the circumstance, you got to stay on the treadmill.
Yeah, I've had those circumstances before. It's not fun.
Hey, you know what? At least you're an advisor that'll shoot someone straight and tell them to get back to work.
Well, you don't get a choice in that one, in my opinion. If you're a fiduciary, there's a difference between being nice and being kind, right? Mm. Nice will sell somebody what they want to hear.
Yeah.
Kind will sell somebody what they need to hear.
That's a very big difference.
Yeah.
So right now, someone is driving in their car and they just had this epiphany. Wait a minute. I should actually see if I can retire. I need someone to analyze this and be kind to me. Not nice. They want someone that's kind. David, how do they get a hold of you personally? What's your cell phone number? 541.
Yeah. Starts with 541.
375.
Then you're going to talk to Emma at 375-0898, and she's going to figure out a time for us to get on the calendar work it out.
There's a gorgeous sign if you're driving down Harvard.
Have a new sign.
Yeah. You can just like pull a U-turn, flip it around. Jump the grass right into the parking lot.
There's actually a much easier way to get in. You could just drive through the driveway.
Okay, do that too.
All right. With that, look, we're long on the segment. Let's do this. We'll take our last break. We're going to come back and we're going to try to give a frame up. So again, if you're looking at yourself and trying to figure out, hey, where am I on this one? A few questions to ask yourselves, and then we'll get you pointed in the right direction. You can figure out, do we need to call or not? So stick around.
You
I'm Dave Littlejohn.
And I'm Dixon.
You got True Wealth. Adoosh Radio, 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
What? Yeah, the ones where they get the donations are like, you got to call right now. This is a limited time offer.
I'm so not hyped. Welcome back to the True Well Show. Dave Littlejohn in studio with
Matt Dixon.
And
where you're about to get sold.
No. it's so funny because that is I've always resisted that on the show.
I know.
Making the offer is fine, but to me this is
aren't you seeing what I'm doing here? I'm painting you as the good guy and I'm the villain. Are you not seeing
you're not the villain.
Oh.
You know, it cuz otherwise we can't be on the same team.
Oh dang.
We all wear the white hats here.
Anytime you have like a podcast, though, or a radio show, one guy's got to be like the adversary. You know, they kind of got to clash heads and then argue the points.
Well, we do, because you say things like, well, the yield has to go up. And I go, uh-uh, the price goes down.
It's going up to the moon.
All right. Well, look, I promised our listeners that I was going to give just a few key questions that one should be asking. And these are sort of the questions that you would get asked by any planner if you were trying to figure out, hey, I need to retire and how much am I going to need and so forth. It's somewhere people got it in their mind that working with a financial person means the first thing you're going to do is they're going to make you show them a budget. Let me just go on record as saying that is one of the least interesting things to me. Budgeting is not a process that I particularly enjoy, the same way that some people really love a good spreadsheet. And while there's utility in them, spreadsheets are not going
Dude,
to be the
you're
thing.
You're breaking my heart, actually, a little bit. I love a budget and I love a spreadsheet. So I'm over here like, take it back.
Well, I believe that the budget of spend less than you make, and that's a great way to start. But I'm wired different than a lot of people. Some people need that budget because that's what creates discipline. I'm not a native spender. I'll save up on purpose to get a thing so that I know that it's okay. I just don't whimsically buy a whole lot of stuff.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. I mean, you said, I don't even like buying toner for our printer. So, well, we have to. So you know what they do? They don't tell me. We have a rule. It's like certain things, just don't tell me that you're doing it, and then it'll be easier for me. It'll just happen, and I'll just agree to it.
You're over there filling the red toner with blood. It's cheaper.
It's
Stop
funny because
it.
If you start a business from a closet by yourself, and you're never fully by yourself, right? I mean, like, my wife was there, and she was part of it at the beginning. All these things that had to happen, but the clients that have been with me since the beginning, when you do that, I remember recycling paperclips. The value of a dollar is not lost on me. So as you grow and the needs change as it gets bigger, but you don't lose track of the value of money. And this is, for anybody listening, just so you know, this is part of the cultural DNA of our firm. Anybody that walks in, there's no point at which you're dismissive about an amount of money, because it's not the size of the portfolio that makes a great client for us.
It's true.
I mean, what is true is if you have no money, then it's hard to be a client, because there's not much to work with. But I don't gauge a person by the thickness of their wallet. Just don't. It's more about, can we work together? I don't know why.
It was
Emma's hysterically laughing over here.
Well,
about
you
something.
Said,
I have no
if
idea.
You don't have any money, well there's not much to work with. And it's like, yeah, there's literally nothing to work with.
this is true, but that's not to say that we can't get somebody on the right path. Right. There are we do this a lot of the time for younger folks. I mean, we have our wealth incubator where we do help people launch. And it is designed. It's a simple, streamlined way to work with us. It's not the same as a full service financial planning relationship, but that's not where you're at. Right. You need to get started and you need somebody that can kind of coach you along the way. That's what our wealth incubator is for. for a lot of folks, though, it's like, look, if you're within a few years of retirement, it's a great time. If you've never talked to somebody, go talk to somebody. Because what you don't want to do is make all of the decisions and then go talk to somebody, because now you've already made the decisions. There's really nothing to work with at that point. There's no levers to pull anymore. You pulled them all. So
fair enough.
That's the issue here is I would encourage you, if you've ever wondered, why do you think there's so many free consults out there? It's designed
to get you in the door.
Yeah, well, and to take the pressure off. So you don't have to look at this and think, well, I'd like to come in. We have so many people that will come in and they'll say, well, what do I owe you? Just because,
oh,
you know,
I know.
We had
that
the
one always cracks.
And it's like nothing. You're kidding, right? So no, the whole purpose is we need to know if it's a good fit too. If we can't serve your needs, we're not going to bill you for that.
Yeah.
Right? We need to establish that the relationship is worth engaging in first. That takes some time. So we put some risk into it just like you do. We take the time and we figure it out. So anyway, that's the backstory to it. The question that I want you guys to ask is, one, do I have a plan? Do I know how much I'm going to spend? Do I have a sense of what I'm going to spend? And then how much am I working with? And then you have to kind of do some really basic math. I want you to take the number you have, divide it by 20, okay? And then the number that you get after that, is that more or less than the number that you need each year? Okay? And if it's less than that, you need to see a financial advisor.
And if it's more than that, you need to see a financial
advisor.
Yeah,
and if it's more than that, you need to see a financial advisor, but it's for different reasons.
Yeah, tax strategy.
Yeah.
Man, so basically everyone needs to see a financial advisor, and David's cell phone number is 541-375-0898.
That is the office line, okay. And that's what we're sticking with.
Okay.
So, yeah, look, don't let nerves be the reason that you don't call somebody. Just reach out. And if it's not us, find somebody. Find somebody that you like, somebody that you trust, that you can do the work with. If you'll do it yourself, great. But if you won't do it yourself, please find somebody else. Look at the clock. We got to run. Until next time, I'm Dave Littlejohn.
And Matt Dixon.
And you've been listening to True Wealth on News Radio 93.9 FM at 1240 KQEN.